It's the morning show. I'm Shireen Seward. In 1978, the Indian Child Welfare Act created minimum federal standards for placing Native children in homes that would reflect the unique values of Indian culture. The law was challenged by the state of Texas and by non-Indian adoptive parents, and the U.S. Supreme Court handed down its decision this month. Join in this discussion, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dehasi Hill is the chairman of the United Nation. Dehasi, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
So how are Native American families feeling about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to uphold this 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act? What was the reaction?
Well, we were very excited. We're always, you know, hopeful, but reserved as Indian policy goes before the Supreme Court. And this particular one has, you know, longstanding history. Passed in 1978 and had very positive impact on tribal communities across the country.
Talk about that a little bit. Why was the Indian Child Welfare Act so important to tribes?
Well, you know, I guess it kind of a little bit more history around it. You know, Congress had studied the issue and reports came back from anywhere from 25 to 35% of all Native children were being removed from their homes. By both state agencies and nonprofits and things like that, adoption agencies. And so tribes have been fighting for keeping our language and our culture and our communities alive, and the removal of our children from our communities had a very detrimental effect on that stability.
So back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, before this was enacted, the children that were removed were being placed elsewhere. They were being placed in homes that were not Native?
Yeah, not Native, and a lot of times even out of the state.
So then this act guaranteed that right then?
It put, I guess, measures in place to be able to place children at a different, I guess, priority with Native within their community, their families, and other Native communities. So it doesn't necessarily block a transfer to a non-Native family, but it just put a priority list in place to be able to go down that list.
And okay. I want to point out that the court's decision leaves an unresolved question. That's whether the law's system of preferences for Native adoptive parents is an unconstitutional racial preference. Are you concerned that this issue could be brought to the courts again?
Yeah, that, you know, anytime it's unresolved by the Supreme Court, there's always a potential for that to come back. And so, you know, as we're strong in our stance that the relationship between Indian nations across the country and the federal government is that of a political one and not a racial one. So that's an argument that we continuously make in defense of these types of arguments.
The Supreme Court's majority opinion said 200 years of legal precedent has given Congress the right to legislate Indian affairs. How do you view the High Court's recognition of the longstanding government-to-government relationship between the U.S. and tribal nations?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the, you know, basic tenets around Indian policy, federal Indian policy, is that relationship. And we were very glad to see that the Supreme Court had relied on those that longstanding history and other court decisions that address this issue. And again, it's just the importance of that government-to-government relationship that tribes have with the federal government that's based on the Constitution, that treaties are made between two governments, and treaties are the supreme law of the land, and that continues to be upheld.
So tribes they interact with the federal government then on more political grounds?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Can we circle back to the act and the placement preferences for Native children? How does this go? If a child is removed from the home, put into the system, where does the child get placed first?
With Oneida, it's I guess we've also enacted, you know, our own family law and put specific placement preferences in place. So it could be slightly different for different tribes across the country. But in general, always checking with family first, relative and things like that. And then other tribal members in the community, other tribes, and so on. So it basically starts like a target with trying to place the child or children within the bullseye would be within the family. But then if that's not possible, then the next ring out, the next ring out, the next ring out, and eventually to a non-tribal family.
Talk a little bit about why you think that's so important. I mean, why is it so important to keep children within the tribes, even to another tribe?
That's really an identity issue that we've been fighting the federal government and state governments on for since the beginning, I guess, that our language and our culture and our way of life and our way of thinking might not be the same as a non-native family, and so trying to instill those views and our language and our culture in our children to carry that on is very important.
DeHasse Hill is the chairman of the Oneida Nation. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward discussing the U.S. Supreme Court's decision upholding the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Law with DeHasse Hill, the chairman of the Oneida Nation. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The Oneida Nation is one of five tribal nations in the country that intervened in this case. Why was the Oneida Nation involved? Why was this so important?
Yes, thank you for that question. I guess the United Nation is, pretty sophisticated in our tribal programs and services that we provide to our tribal members, and we were kind of early adopters into the whole process, into family law and family court and things like that. And so, having a long history of our active engagement in child welfare issues, I think is one of the reasons we were asked to join the case.
I know we touched on this a little bit earlier today, but take us through Wisconsin history a little bit more and the issue of Native American children being separated from their tribes. Why was this happening in the first place?
Well, it really goes back quite some time, with the federal government evolution of Indian policy through the hundreds of years has evolved to where we're at today. But basically, it really had started out with the removal of Native people from their indigenous homelands to reservations. And then from there, there was a mindset about, kill the Indian, save the man. And so boarding schools were started across the country, and the removal of young Indian children from their homes and from their families, and placed in these boarding schools for years and years, and had very little, if any, contact with their families until they were essentially released from the boarding school system. So a lot of times the children were adults by the time they were returning home, and being subject to all types of abuses, both mental, physical, and sexual abuse in these boarding school systems. And then bringing that back home to their reservations had a very detrimental effect on our communities, and how children were raised from those points on was very difficult.
We're talking about the ruling this month from the U.S. Supreme Court that upheld the Indian Child Welfare Act with Oneida Nation Chairman DeHasse Hill. Despite this act and the protections within it. Native children in Wisconsin are still being removed from their tribal homes. The issue is happening in Brown County, Outagamie County, and that's where the Oneida Nation lies. So why are so many children still being separated from their families? Why are they being separated from the families now, even with this in place?
Yeah, I think it really is a systems issue, as foster homes and things like that are in high demand for not only Indian country, but American families in general. And so trying to find a placement within, you know, a family and within a community and within a tribal nation has become much more difficult, especially with the effects of the opioid epidemic that's been facing this country for quite some time now. And so these homes are becoming scarce to the need.
What kinds of tools are in place in the Oneida Nation for foster care? Do you have foster families?
Yeah, we have foster families. There's a lot of different programs in place, kind of respite care and things like that. And then also the ability to utilize our own healthcare systems. We have, primary healthcare through the Oneida Community Health Center. We have behavioral health programs as well to address some of the particular needs of an individual or families, what they go through with the different trauma that happens when children are removed from their families.
Do you see a need for more licensed foster care within the Oneida Nation?
Yes, definitely. That's it's always a need, and wherever and whenever we can, we, you know, speak of it and try to encourage individuals and families to open their home up to young people that are facing a traumatic experience and need a stable, safe home, whether it's temporary or long-term.
Taking a look at the 2021 Wisconsin Department of Children and Families data, it shows that in Brown and Outagamie counties, where the Oneida Nation lies, Native children are less than 1% of children, but more than 20% of removals. Why is that happening, and how do you think that disproportionate number of child welfare cases involving Native kids should be addressed?
It's really an important issue, especially when it comes to, you know, our communities here in Brown and Outagamie County. Obviously, the city of Green Bay also, you know, sits in Brown County, and Appleton in Outagamie County. And so when you have a larger, you know, metropolitan areas, there are, you know, not just Oneidas that live in this area, but tribes from across the country, you know, have located in these urban areas. And so, you know, there's just a far greater, you know, need to be able to address these issues across even, you know, tribal lines to other tribes as well.
We're talking about the Indian Child Welfare Act, but there's another case that's made headlines this week, the Enbridge issue. This week, a federal judge ordered Enbridge to reroute its pipeline away from tribal land in northern Wisconsin within 3 years. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that Enbridge is planning to appeal that decision. And, of course, Line 5 crosses the Bad River Band of Chippewa land. What's your reaction to that court order?
I think anytime we get a court order action that supports tribes and tribal sovereignty, that's an important action. And so here at Oneida, we've also passed a resolution some time ago in support of the Bad River Lake Superior Chippewa to defend its land and its rights to its resources and to be able to protect them.
The federal judge ordering the reroute of the Enbridge pipeline and the Supreme Court upholding the Indian Child Welfare Act, two court rulings in favor of tribes. How are you feeling right now about how the rights of First Nations are being heard?
It definitely ebb and flows with different court decisions, but I think generally overall, the last few years have had some significant victories for tribal nations across the country before the Supreme Court.
What do you think about the future of the Indian Child Welfare Act? I mean, do you see that this is going to continue to be an issue that the courts will grapple with, or is this Is this it? I mean, is this the final word on it for you? I mean, what do you think?
I would definitely hope that it's the final word on challenging ICWA, but you know, as the past and history has proven that it's probably not the case, and there's always individuals and parties, I guess, looking to claw back, I guess, any tribal sovereignty that has been long established, and so tribal nations across this country really take the importance of defending tribal sovereignty at every turn and wherever possible, because the history that has been federal Indian policy has ebbed and flowed back and forth between sovereignty and wards of the state. So there's always these battles, and we expect to continue.
And circling back to the Enbridge case, what do you think the future is there? I mean, do you see that this is going to be tied up for a lot longer? What's going to happen?
Yeah, I definitely see this being tied up a lot longer. As you had mentioned, the likely to appeal. And so, you know, that process takes quite some time, as it did for ICWA. We've been fighting this battle for many years, and then before it got to the Supreme Court. And so if this is on that same track, this could be a battle for several more years before it gets to the Supreme Court, and if they take it up, and then the decision. So,
well, I want to thank you for joining us today and sharing your perspective on these issues. This has been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Shereen. Glad I could be here.
Tehasi Hill is the chairman of the Oneida Nation. I'm Shereen Seewert. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.